Howdy everyone, this is your host Andy Smerit of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Thanks for being with us. Now please join me in welcoming my kind of co-host, kind of fill-in co-host, my favorite co-host, the indicted mayor of the city of Baltimore, the city that reads, Stafford Palmieri.
Hello, Andy.
Happy Veterans Day.
Happy Veterans Day to you, too. I'm glad that I am your favorite co-host. You had your foot about 3 inches away from your mouth, and then you removed it, so.
No. I only say that because you're here with me. Okay, so we have the full slate of activities this week. First, we're going to play Pardon the Gadfly, of course, with the wonderful Janie, and then Amber will do her research minute, and finally, Nikki with Rate That Reform. So with no further ado, Pardon the Gadfly. Janie, what's up?
All right, question one. In a new proposal released by Denver Public Schools, charter schools would become neighborhood schools, forced to accept any and all students within their boundaries who wanted seats. District officials claim this will address the accusations that charter schools only serve high-performing students. Charter advocates think the proposal unduly restrictive. Who's right?
So, I know you feel very strongly about this. Go ahead.
I'm very fired up about this. So, first of all, it is part of the charter model that charter schools are supposed to be choice-based. Mm-hmm. So to change that changes the reason why a lot of us are in this business. But let me just read you two quotes from the superintendent and explain why I'm so upset about it. Quote number one, charter schools are public schools, and they must be public schools in every sense of the word. Let me address that first of all. There is nothing written in scripture, there's nothing written in the Constitution that says that all public schools have to be filled based on geography. That's just something that we've done for 150 years. There's no reason why you can't have a public school system based on choice, like they're doing in more and more places. The second quote, quote, effectively there will be absolutely no distinction between charter schools and district schools. This is the quote of Superintendent Tom Bosberg. Quite simply, I would leave this business if I thought all we were going to do is make charter schools just like district schools. The reason I'm doing this is because I think district schools have ill-served America's poor kids for ages and ages and ages. The reason charter schools are in existence in a lot of these places is because we had to do something different. So put me down for being adamantly opposed to what Denver is doing. What do you think?
I agree with you. I think that this is a media ploy. This is a We need to make charter schools more like public schools kind of media ploy, and it's not going to have any positive effects, and it's just an occasion for the superintendent to stand up and talk a lot of nonsense. You picked two very good quotes.
I would encourage everyone, I already talked about this on the blog, but one of my favorite annual reports comes from the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools, where they do their market share, and they show in all the different cities what percentage of kids are in charter public schools and what are in district public schools. And there are more and more that are over 30%, a handful that are more than 20%, and just gaggles that are more than 10%, just showing, again, that you don't have to have a district structure to have public education. It can be, education can be delivered in a lot of different ways, and the district is not a necessary part of that.
I think another part of this is also that charter schools don't necessarily cream. And one of the superintendent's accusations is that this will dispel the notion that charter schools are only serving high-performing students if they are required to take students from within their boundaries. But we've shown that if a school is in a neighborhood, the kids around it will go to that school, and we don't need to put that into law and force it on the school.
Colorado does have a little bit of an odd charter sector because they have so many suburban and rural charter schools, but in general, you're right, nationwide charter schools have a higher percentage of African-American and Latino kids in the traditional public school sector and an equivalent number of low-income students, so it's not like nationally they're creaming. All right, issue number two.
Maine's new teacher confidentiality laws makes data on teacher licenses, such as how many have been granted, revoked, and surrendered, public, but the law only affects data after mid-September 2009. Now, with calls to make it retroactive, the State Department of Education is balking that there would be nothing to learn from such comparisons. Is the state hiding something or just lazy?
You're fired up about this, though, aren't you?
I wrote this question. I admit it. Lazy. Lazy. I don't, well, maybe they are hiding something, and I would really like to know if they are hiding something. But if you read the comments from the different State Department State Department of Education officials, it's all about, well, you know, cleaning this data and releasing it would be very difficult and blah, blah, blah. And they just don't want to make the effort to make the data presentable to the public, and it would just be a lot of extra work for them. But, yes, this law will be much more beneficial in 5 years when we have 5 years of data to look at it, but why not make it retroactive now? I mean, it's not like anyone's career is really going to be on the line because of this. It's all in the aggregate, so this is just laziness.
Well, we should ask Amber what she thinks when she finally swoops in here to do her research minute. But the research piece of this actually does make me, I'm just fascinated to find out if they're actually hiding something. Is there something that happened 5 years ago that they just don't want us to know about? For example, did they have to do a purge then, or have they just not gotten rid of any teachers over the past decade? Is there more to this story? I don't know. I guess part of me is just happy that, heck, we're going to get this data, and 5 years from now we'll know more than we did 5 years ago. But
maybe Arnie Duncan will write an editorial about it.
No. See, you don't understand. Washington,
I don't want to encourage him.
Washington doesn't have all the answers.
Oh, that's right. That's right. When he was superintendent of Chicago, he always knew.
States can get all the stuff right themselves. All right, issue number 3.
About 6 months ago, Tennessee raised its charter cap. But just yesterday, Metro Nashville Public Schools denied the applications of all its new charter applicants. That means Nashville's current charters will soldier on another year at the current count of 5. Were this year's applications truly inferior, or was the district protecting its funding in a year of budgetary stress?
Now, this is interesting, because not only were those charters denied, but 2 days earlier, Memphis denied 18 charter applications. So what I've been writing a bit about is everyone celebrated a couple months ago when Tennessee lifted their charter cap. Hurrah, hurrah, Tennessee's going to get a lot more charter schools. And then, because it's left up to districts, they deny all the charter applications who came to them. So there's a difference between what a state law says and then what actually happens in practice. So it just makes me skeptical, in general, that state charter law changes are necessarily going to lead to more charters. In this case, so let's give them the benefit of that for the time being. Maybe it's the case that all 18 in Memphis and all 6 or 7 or 8 in Nashville were bad and the district was being a conscientious authorizer. Having been in the charter world for a while, I kind of know that in general, when a district shuts down every single application that comes to it, it's not just because they're being conscientious, there's something more to the story, like they don't like charter schools or they have some sort of budgetary issue. So this is something we should definitely keep an eye on. When a state changes its charter cap, does that actually mean that they're going to get more charters, or are they just trying to get race to the top money? What do you think?
I think another solution to this, if states really want to see if their laws are producing more charter schools, is to actually encourage non-district authorizers or make it possible. I don't know what the law is in Tennessee about having a non-district authorizer, but it doesn't make sense to have all the authorizers be just districts, because there's obviously a conflict of interest there. We've talked about this before. So the state could encourage other people to get into this game, and then when we have, you know, 20 applications in 2 different cities, we can have 2 objective, or we could have 2 groups reviewing them, one district, one non-district, and we can actually see the real story and see if there is an ulterior motive here.
Yeah, I recommend another brief report to our wonderful listeners. The NACSA, the National Association of Charter School Authorizers, came out with just some really interesting descriptive statistics in the past, say, 3 months or so, showing the difference between states that have different types of authorizers, how many schools a district would authorize on average, how many a non-district authorizer would authorize, and many interesting things. And the point you made is actually completely true and has been since the beginning of the charter sector, that non-district authorizers have a tendency to do more charters than districts for obvious reasons, because of competitive reasons. But it does make us look at Tennessee and say, well, if your districts, assuming that they did it for nefarious reasons as opposed to conscientious reasons, if they're denying all these applications, maybe that means create a statewide Tennessee authorizing board.
Yeah.
Maybe Secretary Duncan could write a letter to the Tennessean, what's their newspaper?
The Tennessean.
Recommending that change. But Washington doesn't have the answers. Okay. Great job with that. I like those questions.
I'm glad. I enjoy writing them.
All right. So now, my favorite part of the show, Amber, with the research minute.
It's firing everybody up today.
Well, I'm in a good mood today for some reason. There's no traffic. So how are you, Amber?
Yeah, great. There was no traffic. I was so excited about that myself.
It's because no one is working today
except
us.
Boy, that was subtle, guys.
ten whole days a year. That's what we get here.
Well, Janie and I have actually been trying to track down some data today, and she's been making these phone calls, and everywhere is closed.
Well, let's just say, to turn this around, so we should thank our troops and all our men and women in the armed services and the folks who have came before them and done such a great job 1 day a year. Certainly not enough to honor them for all their great sacrifices for the country.
this week, we have a new study called Leaders and Laggards by the Center for American Progress, AEI, and a couple other partners. It's a follow-up report that grades states on how friendly they are to innovative educational practices. It examines 8 individual areas, including staff hiring and evaluation practices, school management, finance, and the robustness of a state's data system. Overall, grades to states are not awarded, but not a single state earned A's in more than one or two areas. Most receive lots of C's and D's. Analysts found some unsurprising results. For instance, teacher evaluations are not based on performance, blah, blah, we know that. Major barriers exist to removing poor performing teachers, we know that. And schools provide too little access to college level work, I think we know that. The report is interesting, somewhat, but the data to support some of the indicators are thin, mostly because meaningful outcome data are hard to come by, a point that the authors readily admit. For example, states collect data on student access to computers, but not return on investment studies with technology. They close with several recommendations to help states bridge the innovation gap, like you need to develop more flexible approaches to school funding, we know that. You need to link teacher pay to student performance, we know that. You need to support, this was kind of interesting, you need to support capacity building organizations like the Charter School Growth Fund and others. And you need to create bridge programs from high school to college, like dual enrollment courses.
Mm.
It was a little long.
It was a little long.
I mean, it was, I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of glad Rick's not here. Obviously, he was one of the authors.
Wow.
Truth be told, he's doing a similar report for us later on. But the data just weren't there. You know, when you dig in and sort of the back and the, you know, kind of figure out how they operationalize each one of these big 8 categories.
Mm-hmm.
Just the data, they're interesting questions, but the data aren't there, they're really sparse, so they had to, like, you know, take a one question off of the SAS survey, you know, and I don't know, just, they admitted, you know, that it was very disappointing that they didn't have the data to sort of do a better job, but I guess I wonder if we could have waited or not, maybe not looked at so many indicators, maybe just looked at the ones where the data were more robust.
So let me ask you about how this applies to Race to the Top, because
yes.
The Department of Education, even though I criticize some things they do, they've been doing a lot of work on Race to the Top application, trying to figure out which state should get this money or not, and this is going to become a big deal soon when applications start going in. So one thing I presume the department and other folks, like the peer reviewers, are going to look at is trying to figure out which states are really committed to reform,
right.
And they're going to pull up this document and see states listed 1 to 50, which get A's, B's, C's. So, to be fair, how much of this should they take seriously? What should they question? Should they just dismiss the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I would dismiss the whole thing, but I think people, you know, we tend to put a lot of weight, as you said before the podcast started, on a grade, you know?
Yep.
I mean, and I think if you know, you get an A on finance and it's based entirely on whether or not you have a per pupil weighted student funding, then you should know that's
right.
All it's looking at. And I'm not saying it is, but I'm just saying that's one indicator that stuck out at me. And if you're looking at things like school management, and one of the main indicators is did a teacher say on the staff survey that she's got too much paperwork to do, and that's one of the ways that we're managing sort of school culture and school management practices, then, I mean, I just think they need to be informed. I don't think you should toss it out, but I think that they need to look at more than the grades.
So were there any outliers that were really interesting, like the cup 5 at the top or 5 at the bottom, where you said, oh, that doesn't fit, or that?
Yeah, not really. I mean, I think they were wise not to give an overall grade. They gave a separate grade in all 8 categories.
Yep.
They gave a couple gold stars, like, you know, Hawaii got a gold star for finance, since they do that, you know, per,
mm-hmm.
per people. And then a couple other states, Ohio got a star for being strict on charter accountability. Not sure about that one, but
okay, so maybe we can look at this as a preliminary report.
Right, preliminary report. Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to build. I think what's really important is this is only the second installment of these leaders and laggards. I did one last year. I imagine they're going to do 2 years ago.
Two years ago.
So I imagine there's going to be another follow up to this one. And I know Rick is, you know, really good about, you know, building on reports and sort of expanding what we know. I think it's best looked at as a stepping stone to and a call to action that we need even more good information about some of these things that we care a lot about.
Interesting.
A piece of this that I actually really liked was that they didn't focus on specific reforms that we should be endorsing. So unlike Race to the Top, where we have sort of a list of things that states should be doing or states should be trying to do that will get them money, this is more our states opening doors, our states breaking down red tape, our states making a climate in their state that invites business leaders, invites people with interesting ideas to come
right.
to their
but
state.
Interestingly enough, they also pull on some of the things that are prioritized in the race to the top, like, you know, states should really sign on to common standards and the recommendations. States should really look at giving kids more time in school and the school year and adding time. So there are definitely some, you know, priorities from Ed that were reflected in the report.
Interesting stuff. So overall, the folks at the Department of Education, when they're looking at Race to the Top applications, they should maybe read this report, but just grain of salt, read it judiciously.
Right, and you know, I wanted to bring this up. So Randy Weingarten said the report reflected old hat top-down measures that have failed to transform our schools, so that's got to be good.
Oh my heavens.
Yeah, and if you're Jay Matthews,
yeah.
you'll make Randy Weingarten Michelle Rhee's successor when she gets married.
We should do a whole podcast just on that.
Actually, I think the suggestion is so ridiculous that I wouldn't waste the time discussing it on an entire podcast.
Ouch. Jay, I still like you.
I still like you too, Jay. Just,
so do we have any music to...
Some brain freeze. All right, so the song, since states are mediocre on the innovation front, we have Stuck in the Middle with You by Steeler's Wheel.
Right here I am, stuck in the middle. Smile from my face, losing control, yeah, I'm all over the place. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right, here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
All right, good work, fantastic. All right, so now we
here's
have
our freestyler.
The freestyler himself. Laura, can you just drop a beat for Mickey?
Mama, mama, mama.
So how are you, Mickey?
I'm pretty good, pretty good.
Happy Veterans Day to you.
Same to you, Andy.
So tell us about, what's the subject, the reform you're rating?
The reform I'm rating has to do with a flash mob.
A flash mob? Do tell.
That was a great intro. Okay, so last week, students at Danver High School in Oregon decided to organize a flash mob, essentially using Facebook to quietly plan a group disruption at school. While all the details of the event haven't been made clear, it had something to do with a hallway, skipping out of class, and displaying or saying a single word in unison. That word is meep. Or as Beaker from The Muppets says, meep.
Come again?
Meep. M-E-E-P.
Meep.
Meep. Okay, so the principal, Thomas Murray, caught on, and in anticipation of the event, he sent out these automated messages, phone messages to parents, warning that their kids could face suspension for saying or displaying that particular nonsense word. When the day came, though, there was no flash mob, though the word in question was displayed and uttered by a few students, and those students were suspended.
For, just to be clear, for saying the word meep.
For in conjunction with an organized disruption of class.
Meep.
I'd hate to be the one who had to write up that suspension form, the reason student is suspended. He said meep.
Well, so the principal has been, you know, contacted by the media and else, and he's actually made quite clear, at least in the article that I read, that it wasn't just the word meep, but that it had to do with this organized disruption of class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that meep was, you know, it wasn't trying to impinge on people's First Amendment rights. It was just that, you know, this was part of something that kids were doing that as a whole was disruptive.
This is so random. So do you have a grade for this?
Yeah. So I'm going to give it an A-. The principal's response. Yes, the principal's response an A minus. Because I think that, again, we don't have all the details, but if it was this kind of thing where students said on Facebook, right, you know, 9:30 on Tuesday afternoon, everybody, you know, go to class and start saying meep, and whenever a teacher asks you a question, just say meep in response. And apparently there's a display element too, so people are going to bring, you know, signs or something. That was ridiculous and not worth disrupting class for, and I think the principal is right to intervene and make sure that didn't happen.
I have a question first.
Yeah, please.
I want to know how many times Mickey has said meep in the last 5 minutes.
Laura, you have to cut that off.
Yes,
during
Laura,
the
please.
Process.
I think it's over 20.
That's where it is.
So, just to end this, is there any harder, more thankless job than being a high school principal or assistant principal? I mean, every day it's probably something like this. I mean, they do great work. Sometimes I just feel bad for them. Honey, what do you do at work today? I stopped a flash mob of kids from saying the word meat. I mean, how did you want to like make sure the kids learn more and get prepared for college and so forth, and instead you're trying to stop this stuff? God bless our vice principals and principals of America's high schools.
That is a difficult and praiseworthy job that they do.
Good for them. Very good. Rate that reform. I like it. Any final words here, Stafford?
No final words, but I want to tell Jay Matthews that I still have a lot of respect for you, even though you think Randy Weingarten should be Chancellor of D.C. That's all I have to say on that topic.
Yeah. Okay.
Moving on.
Thank you, everyone, for being with us. It was a great time. Make sure that you join us at edexcellence.net every week for the Gadfly, and check in with Flypaper, the blog. Till next week, I'm Andy Smerick.
And I'm Stafford Palmieri.
Have a good week.